You're about to enjoy TryHards, courtesy of MTGCast.com. If you enjoy TryHards or anything else supplied by MTGCast, please make a donation. Whether it's recurring or one time, you can help offset the very real overhead of bringing you the best podcasts in magic every week. MTGCast at MTGCast.com. I had presented an illegal 53-card deck.
It will go down in value as people adjust to it, and then all of a sudden it's going to pop back up a month later.
What would be the modern equivalent of Ticket to Ride? What would be the legacy equivalent of Ticket to Ride?
The only piece of text that this is missing to have me just completely salivating over myself would be...
I don't care if I lose 25 games.
You know, the most powerful Planeswalker ever.
Hurley, you can fight me on that if you want to.
We just know our own game very well.
Because, you know, I'm a brain-dead idiot sometimes.
Oh, you brave soul. Thanks for joining us for another episode of TryHards. I'm Sean Seacrest, along with Brian Tibbetts and Matt Hurley. Guys, I know there's one thing we can agree on. Going to the liquor store in the morning means you know you're going to have a great day.
I don't even know how to respond to that, but you're absolutely right.
Well, we're going to find out if that's the way it works. We get it started each week here on TryHards with What Are You Drinking? I made the run. We're recording the afternoon before 4th of July because of scheduling, and this should be fantastic. I'm having a lot of fun already with my standby, my session IPA. Yes, the Founders All Day IPA, because you can't drink all day if you don't start in the morning. Brian, you were just down here for the weekend. You drinking something you took home from Quincy?
Yes, I am. I've got a little bit of the Urban Chestnut Fantasy Land, because I think casting in the afternoon, I feel like I'm in Fantasy Land in the basement all by myself with magic, beer, and good friends. It's just kind of one of those things that doesn't happen very often, so delicious.
Hurley, what are you doing in Louisville?
So we're having people over tonight. I had to run to Aldi's to get some party supplies, like some dips and stuff. And they had another four-pack of those Tall Boys IPAs, and they're really good. So I'm having one of their IPAs from Aldi's brand.
Now, this is the second time you've talked about this, so I'm going to have to look the next time I hit said store in my neighborhood, because it's the only place in town that sells the Red Hot Riplets from my hometown of St. Louis. So I go there anyway, so I will check out this Aldi brand IPA that you're talking about. If it's not as good as you say, I'm sending you the bill.
I'm on board with that 100%.
All right. We'll see if that's the way it turns out to be. Let's get things started with what magic we played. Matt, what magic did you play over the weekend? Because Brian and I got the rare chance to play in the same event.
Being a Monday morning, I was up really early, even though I'm off work today. And so I didn't really want to start getting too deep in cleaning and waking Lauren up. So I decided, I'm like, I'll lock myself in my office and run through a league. We ran the blue-red Delver list that we did for our patrons. I ran through a league on yesterday and on Sunday and then Monday morning. And I have to say, Brian and I were talking a little bit before the cast. I have to say, I really, really like the deck. I like it better than I thought I would. There's still some tweaking we need to do. I'd say two cards off, maybe something like that. I'm really looking forward to maybe running through a few more leagues and building up the card pool so I can actually play it myself. But I have to say, a big shout out to Pat from Leaving a Legacy. He let us borrow all of the cards for the deck, and he said, have fun with it and tell me what you guys think. He loves the deck, so big thank you for that.
Pat Uglow, part of the Leaving a Legacy podcast, thanks for the assist. Yeah, they kind of have talked about some of the things that we've talked about as well, as do you want to maintain both a paper and digital collection? So far, Hurley, you're the only one who's really delved into that, and we'll see how that ends up going forward with trying to maintain both as you grow that online and we look to do some other things. Brian was actually in Q-Town this weekend, and we got to play in several events together. A couple of them were even Magic. Brian, how'd your weekend go as the guest at my LGS over the weekend?
Phenomenal, for many reasons, Magic included. Friday night, we got to play in a two-headed giant draft format, which was actually, everybody's been poo-pooing that, but Sean, I think you'll agree, that was a lot of fun. I know you were brewing and building and playing with the Padawan, Rachel, who was delightful. I got to work with Wolfmeyer, who's been on, I've been traveled with, of course, in the past and things, so that was great. We had the distinction of going 3-1 and not doing a single point of damage to our opponent because of the approach of the Second Sun card. Our entire premise, and it worked out really well, was to just cast creatures to block and chump block, and then to just find Approach of the Second Sun, which I did three out of the four matches in like my opening hand, I believe. Mill again to get it very quickly, and then cast it again and win the game. So the first round we lost because I just couldn't find any lands in my deck, which was a little unfortunate. And then we went 3-0 the rest of the way, which was really, really fun. So testing Standard with Sean, and he's got a brew that we did up, and I had a couple decks to throw at him that way. We got some Legacy testing in, and then and we even made it up to the shop on Saturday and played in the Standard Showdown, which my deck didn't perform as well as I wanted it to. I was playing the blue-red spells deck that won me the Amonkhet Game Day, and got rolled by the blue-white Monument deck, and then Sean beat me in round three with his Jeskai Control 2-1, so it was a little disappointing, but I would put both of those on me. I didn't play as tightly as I should have. Should have been a little bit more patient in a couple turns, but it was a ball all the way around.
Yeah, I was at a lot of those same events, of course, at the LGS with Brian in town. And the two-headed giant Amonkhet draft, it went down like this. You sat opposite the draft pod with your partner, and then you put your two pools together and built two decks. You started with your life total of 30, and you understand where it goes from there. I didn't expect it to be as much fun as it was. Brian, I'm in total agreement with you there. Do I want to see this be a sanctioned a Wizards GP format, an SCG format? Absolutely not. But its place is at Friday Night Magic. Its place is maybe as a side event at a GP or an SCG. This is not main event material, but I had absolutely way more fun than I thought I would have. And it was just a fun palate-cleansing way to play before pre-release coming up this weekend. So got to play at the Saturday Showdown with Brian as well, as he mentioned. I had a little interesting moment at the Saturday Showdown. I didn't get to play the deck I've been working on because I'm missing four key cards for Liliana's Death Majesty. It's a black-red reanimator deck for Standard. So I played my Jeskai Control deck, and my first-round opponent was playing a black-red aggro deck, and he rolled me up pretty easily, and I was getting frustrated. I can't find these cards with cards not in my deck. Like, I can't draw to it. I count my deck after the match. I had presented an illegal 53-card deck because I had... I had taken those cards out to put them in another brew that I was working on and never put them back. So luckily I had the brew also in the bag. So I was able to put the cards back in the deck for round two, which I then won, and then won the showdown with Brian in round three as well. So I was taking a loss either way in round one, either for presenting an illegal deck or for not actually being able to win when you don't have your finishers, your planeswalkers or anything, and you're playing control and you have a 27 land 53 card, you know, illegal deck. That makes it pretty hard to roll in that fashion, but a lot of fun all the way around this weekend. Rachel continues to develop. Playing with her in that two-headed giant was a ton of fun and a different perspective for me, because it's been years since I've done that with anybody except Brian, teaming up for stuff. So it was interesting to play with a different teammate with a different style of play along the way. We were 2-1-1. The only match we lost, I didn't draw any lands, so she was playing like 1-on-2, and then the draw happened. We had control of the match, but just ran out of time in turns, so that wasn't too disappointing. I was really happy with the way it played out. That was the Magic we got to play this weekend. I hope you had a great time, and I hope you have a great time this coming weekend with the pre-release coming up. We have one new patron that we have to shout out to, guys. And because of the pre-existing relationship, I'm going to let Hurley do the shouting out. Greg Platt, he is a friend of the cast, and Matt has an actual history with Greg. Greg is, and I'm going to say this in a complimentary way, notoriously tight. So Greg, thank you for reaching in the wallet, dusting off a couple of those dollars, and shipping them our way here on Tryhards. Matt, I know you probably have a hello and a thank you you'd like to send to Greg.
Yeah, Greg, thanks if you're listening to this episode, and I will definitely make fun of you for some other reason now, not just for being cheap with your money.
That is a little bit more conciliatory than I thought Matt might be. Matt and Greg,
I don't want to air all the dirty laundry out.
Okay, you know, well, very good. I'll just say this then. Matt and Greg are veterans. They served our country together abroad, and they've known each other for a very long time. So again, as we record around 4th of July, Matt, thank you for your service. Greg, you as well. You want to check us out at Patreon, patreon.com/tryhard. The link will be in the show notes. That brings us up to the big tournament this weekend, the SCG Invitational. This has become a large enough tournament that Wizards now actually includes it on the Mothership Premium Events calendar. That, to me, is a real nod of the cap by Wizards. The Envy featured 547 players. It was played with 8 rounds of Modern, 8 rounds of Standard, and then the top 8 was decided with Modern decks. Brian Koval on Death and Taxes defeated Daniel Fournier 3-1. Fournier was on Grixis Shadow, the traditional powerhouse of the format at the moment. Matt, Death and Taxes now seems to be spreading its taxing mindset to Modern. Basically, all the Legacy version of this deck doesn't have is the Legacy land base. Nearly all the other creatures are available, and you get some Modern quote-unquote upgrades because of the slightly slower format compared to Legacy of Modern. You can actually get to a 4-drop and play a powerhouse like Restoration Angel. Is this going to be a new pillar of Modern going forward, or is this just a homebrew that somebody got very good at piloting, and you can frankly win if you know your deck that well?
The way I look at this, I really think this is a very powerful deck. It's popped up before on some of the leagues and stuff like that. Not this exact build. This is the first time I've actually seen Weathered Wayfarer in the main. Those cards are surprisingly expensive. They're like $12 cards. I think this has a lot of play against the fair decks of the format, but outside of Thalia and Path to Exile, I don't really think that these have much play against those, you know, the non-fair decks, the Storm decks. You can, with Leonina Arbiter, you can get a little bit there. And, of course, with Sunlance, you can maybe get there. But, yeah, overall, I just think it doesn't have that much game against those combo decks. Watch his little deck tech. I got to give him a shout-out for the Destal Dawn in the sideboard, where he's just basically like, oh, yeah, you know, I just cast this, and then, you know, sometimes it hits and sometimes it doesn't, but it doesn't hit most of my creatures, so I'm good with it.
Brian, we're looking at a deck here that is leveraging Thraven Inspector in Modern. Sarah Avenger has seen the spotlight before. Restoration Angel and Mirren Crusader all in the main deck of the same deck, a deck that includes Sunlance. So this is a deck that knows what it wants to do, and it's to try and take advantage with these value prison-type creatures and then cheat them with its Aether Vial draw. You throw in Phyrexian Revoker, and suddenly this starts to have the feel of a Legacy deck. You have previously said that about how the Death Shadow decks play out, whether it's Sultai or Grixis. Is this Death and Taxes deck for real, and can it continue to cope with the power of Death Shadow?
Oh, I definitely think it can cope with Death Shadow, as we saw this weekend. It's a deck that doesn't do well to big creatures early, but Death Shadow doesn't seem to get big creatures on the board until maybe, you know, turn 4, possibly 5, if they're lucky to get out an early Tarmogoyf and things that it can stumble. The Death and Taxes, as you said, Sean, the prison style effects that it has, I think give this a lot of play for those matchups. And it just ran over Eldrazi Tron in the tournament. And so that was kind of one of those things where Eldrazi Tron just needs a little bit of time to set up. And this deck just took advantage of that all ways, shapes, and forms. So when you're facing a deck that has 29 creatures in it and then 4 Aether Vials, you're going to be just expecting this onslaught of creatures. And even something like an All is Dust is just not going to take care of that stuff. The spot removal from Grixis Death Shadow is just not going to be able to deal with that. So, yeah, this is definitely one of those things going forward. I kind of look at this as more of almost like a company deck where the creatures just keep coming just in a different way than the company decks get them out onto the battlefield.
You might be thinking it's odd that a big mana deck like Tron wouldn't be able to deal with or pay the cost of a taxing deck, but they use their mana in small increments to help set up early in the game. And if you're taxed on those effects, it'll put a big mana deck way behind, whether it's Pure Tron, Eldrazi Tron, or whatever you may have. Brian, top 8 for this: 2 Grixis Death Shadow, 2 Eldrazi Tron, Death and Taxes, Abzan Burn, and Lantern Control. That seems like a pretty routine Modern top 8 grouping to me.
I don't know if I would say routine, because next week I would expect, if there was a Modern tournament being played, which there's nothing big because of pre-release, I would expect this to be, you know, maybe 4 of these decks and 4 other decks in a top 8 just because of how healthy the format is. Hurley, you can fight me on that if you want to. Lantern Control seems to be the outlier here, but I just attribute that to Adrian Sullivan being a very, very adept player. And, you know, to get into the top 8, you had to do well in Standard as well. But Burn seems to have a place here. I'm a little surprised by the lack of affinity in the top 8, but it's not that surprising just because I think, you know, Modern's its peaks and valleys, and I'm sure there were some affinity decks in probably 9 through 16. So this seems really, really healthy to me. There's a lot to play, And now some people I know, I was hearing it on the SCG coverage with Cedric and the gang, that they were saying, is Modern too wide open? And I'm thinking, oh God, here we go. Everybody complains when one deck's too powerful, and now we're saying it's too wide open. How can a format be too wide open?
Brian, we have to remember that Affinity had the big weekend in Vegas, so everybody was probably packing their sideboard hate, and that may be what cost it ultimately a chance to top eight. Matt, when you look at a split format tournament like this, the rules seem to be a little bit different based on the format. Modern, if you know it and you play it and you know your deck inside out, anything is practically viable. Standard, on the other hand, was going to be a surprise because of the recent bannings and the sort of ship-in-a-bottle type feel before it switches with the release of Hour of Devastation next weekend. Standard, though, surprised me. There was almost a renewed commitment to going wide with the white-based Monument decks. Is this something you think has some staying power, or is this taking advantage of a meta at this one weekend tournament?
I can't put a ton of stock into these lists just because it will change. And I think we'll talk about this later. I think that Hour of Devastation has some very subtle, powerful cards in it. I love the idea of these going wide decks. I do think there's something there. The only thing that sucks is in October, you literally lose everything in the deck. I mean, outside of like the Oketra's Monument and the Dust Till Dawns. I really like these Oketra's Monument decks. Reminds me of when we were at the pre-release for the sets, Amonkhet sets, I pulled two Oketra's Monument. I was playing them in my pool, and people are like, oh, that card is terrible. I'm like, are we reading the same card? I never heard one person say, oh, yeah, that card's awesome. No, it was, that card's terrible. I don't know why you're playing it. I'm a little surprised that it took this long to kind of develop these go-wide decks.
All right, guys, first of two lightning round questions today. Matt, I'll start with you. Do you like split format tournaments like we saw at the Invitational?
I think so. I should say I do. I don't know if I prefer kind of like a draft and a constructed, or if I prefer two different constructed formats. They're very close for me, but I think the draft and the constructed format, whether it be Modern, even Legacy or Standard, it taxes people, these pros, a lot more, because we have a lot of pros who are very good at constructed, but they're not so good at draft, and vice versa as well.
Brian, same question. Do you like tournaments with split formats?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think you should judge an invitational or a champion of any kind that you're going to give that much money to and that kind of prestige to somebody who can just be good at limited or just be good at one format. I think you've got to test their mettle over multiple formats. So I'd like to see it maybe expand to three.
That is an answer I didn't expect to get. Three formats for an invitational weekend. I have to roll around what that might look like in my
well,
head.
Well, two's fine. Two's fine. I mean, it really is. But I like either limited and standard, standard and modern, modern and legacy. You know, legacy and limited, it's got to be kind of like a, you know, the little brother, big sister, whatever you want to call it, to the other. I'm not sure I would go that far, but I feel like at least two is good, and they should be somewhat related. So standard and modern seems to be a very, very good fit right now.
Yeah, I would agree. I like the two format tournaments. I'd like to see standard and legacy, me being me, and we have seen that from SCG in the past. Here's hoping they return to that, not permanently, but just maybe as a one-of format for the next Invitational going forward. Other events there this weekend along with the Invitational, the Modern Open drew 563. Peter Terbergen on Affinity took down Eli Cassis on Grixis Shadow 2-0. The Modern Classic at 151. Peter DeBorgia on Merfolk took down Nathaniel Wilson on Green-Black Tron 2-0. And then the Standard Classic with 156 saw Jadeen Klomparens on Black Green Energy knock off James O'Shaughnessy on Tamer Delirium, also 2-0. Brian, did you find yourself wondering what was going on in the other events, or were you totally captivated by the Envy, and how far will you mine deck lists for technology after this weekend into the Modern Open, Modern Classic, or even Standard Classic?
As I've argued before, Modern, I think, is open enough to where if you want to run one of the decks that has top-aided some kind of competitive tournament in the last 4 months, I think you have the ability to do so. It's going to come down to matchups. It's going to come down to sideboards. It's going to come down to, you know, good play, obviously, and some other things. But I think the format is wide open enough. So people aren't scrambling to find best deck in the format in Modern to say, oh, yeah, that's the one we want. I think a lot of people might have done that with Grixis Death Shadow already and then find out how hard it is to pilot and said, eh, I need something a little bit more straightforward, perhaps. Mining deck lists for going forward, That would be interesting. Newer players might be doing that, looking forward to. Established players are probably just going to be tuning what they already have, trying to figure out what the metagame might be and anticipate what that might be for whatever event's coming up.
Matt, you've been a longtime proponent of the 9 through 32 deck lists, not just for technology, but also for financial ramifications as well. Is a modern open on the same weekend as an invitational worth delving into? And does that cascade then down to classics?
Oh, yeah. Key point here. You see this blue red control deck on the standard side where he got 11th place, was running 3 Sweltering Suns main deck. Now, I can tell you that when he was making that deck, he probably had like 1 Sweltering Suns main and 2 side. But then with all the white-blue monuments running around, he upped it for this. It's easier to kind of see where people adjust their numbers to adjust to what the main event was. But these side events, you saw a lot more mono black zombies. I'm not exactly sure why the mono black zombies was so much more powerful in the standard classic than it was in the main. And then the modern classic, I mean, you even saw a 4th place blue black fairies. I mean, they had a blue black improvised list with Tezzeret, Agent of Bolas, you know, the most powerful planeswalker ever.
nice.
And I mean, that was in 9th place. So it's just a lot of cool, you know, they had white red prison and during ideal deck in 16th place. It's just so much fun to see all this stuff going on. When I see Form of the Dragon, Dovescape, copy enchantment in a deck, I'm just like, what is this?
Certainly a lot of research out there to be done if you want to get out to the fringes of any format. That's what these weekends, in my mind, are so good for. You have so many different events going on, players being knocked out or not qualified for one, deciding to stretch their leg at another event, and you end up with a lot of good technology and a lot of resources. That brings us up to this week's news. Guys, the full Hour of Devastation set is now available on the visual spoiler at the Mothership. Most of your card retailing sites also have it up along with their pre-release prices for them. Now that we know everything that's in the set, Brian, are you looking forward to pre-ordering this set, pre-ordering specific cards, or just hitting up what you can? I know your vacation is going to take you away from the pre-release, which actually takes you away from your best format in sealed. Don't worry, you'll have another chance to play sometime in the future. Hour of Devastation, essentially, on a scale of 1 to 10, what's your excitement level, and what specific cards, if any, are you sort of salivating to get your hands on?
I would say my excitement level is probably 7 right now, and I would say that 7 is only tempered by the fact that I'm not going to be here for a pre-release, and I'm not going to be able to jump into the set as early as I would like, so I'm trying to play cool and be like, yeah, it's cool, I'll get to it when I get to it, only because my vacation's getting in the way. I'm really excited to get my hands on a Bolas Planeswalker. There is no doubt about that. I cannot wait. I don't care if I lose 25 games. I just want to be able to cast that card, activate some abilities, and kind of see what happens and see the look on my opponent's face. That sounds pretty fun. There are some cards I'm excited about for kind of upgrading blue-red control. Supreme Will, a Braid. Some of those look really, really good, and I'm kind of excited to see what people do with the blue-black control. I'm looking forward to seeing what Serrani can do on that side. I just kind of look to him anytime there's some really good blue and black control cards, and he's already started to slake my thirst, on that. Is he's already got a list of control cards that he can go forward with Hour of Devastation. It looks like a really fun, strong set with synergy of what we already have, and I hope Wizards can reap the benefits of that, because I kind of think they need a thumbs up from the community after kind of this 5 to 6 months of turmoil we've been having coming out on the other side smelling like a rose.
Matt, what's your excitement level revving up to be right now, and what are you looking forward to?
I'm kind of in the same boat with Brian. I'm really excited for this set, but I think, unfortunately, until the rotation happens, they're not going to have a ton of impact on standard. You know, you're probably going to see some new decks pop up or some tweaks here and there, but you're not going to get the powerhouse. And I think part of that is this is a very synergistic-looking set. It's got a lot of cards in it that are not powerful, like just on the surface of the card, but when they're combined together, you know, with multiple other cards, it looks like it could be very, very powerful. If somebody said this, and I didn't play during this era, but when they went from the Urza's Block into Mercadia Mask, what they were saying there was that, you know, we've had some very powerful sets here in the last few sets, and then now they're kind of toning down the power. So these new sets are going to be subdued slightly until the other sets rotate out, and then all of a sudden it's going to be like a brand new standard format. One of the big cards that you guys laughed at me about this, but one of the cards I'm really curious about, it's actually an uncommon, is the Obelisk Spider, which is the 1/4 reach that costs one colorless, a green, and a black. And whenever it deals combat damage to a creature, put -1/-1 counter on that creature. And whenever you put one or more -1/-1 counters on a creature, each opponent loses a life and you gain a life. I'm sorry, you guys can laugh at me all you want. It's only a 3-drop. If you're playing this in some sort of green-black shell, anywhere where there's a Vendilion Click or there's any flyers that you really have to deal with, I think this card's really powerful. I mean, it survives Bolt and Modern. I think this might be one that's just flying under the radar that people are like, okay, I'm going to use this.
It's interesting that you made the Urza's Block reference, because Standard with Marvel really had sort of a combo winter that led to that ban. So it'll be interesting to see how it bounces back with Hour of Devastation coming out and the bans that are already in place. I think Brian hit my number on the head. I'm about a 6, and here's why. Normally, for the large arc of storytelling and the return of Nicol Bolas, I would be even more geeked than this. But Wizards actually shot my own excitement right in the foot by announcing that we're going back to Dominaria in the future. I'm literally more geeked about that than I am about the Gatewatch finally showing their and being knocked around, which has been long, long, long overdue. So we'll see how this exactly plays out. I think about this set, and when the visual pre-spoilers I've seen, or visual card image gallery, whatever we're supposed to say now other than the word spoiler, this to me seems like the seams on a baseball. It's not the center that gives the ball its livelihood and its jump. It's not the sweet spot where you want to hit it or sign it if you've ever had that opportunity. It's not the nameplate where you see Major League Baseball or whatever association yours come from, but it holds it together. I think things like a Braid, things like Solemnity, they're going to define the format in a way going forward that lets you get a grip on it. And one of those things is our next lightning round question here on this episode of Tryhards, and that's the return of color hosers. Wizards really used to print these regularly way back in the prehistory of sets, and then there was a renaissance of thinking, and they got away from hosers and even denounced them for a long, long time. Now they're sort of creeping back the other way. Yes, they want to showcase the narrative of the Gatewatch being defeated, but Brian, I'm going to start with you. Color hosers have now returned. Are those good or bad for Magic?
I think color hosers are totally fine in Magic because they have to be used efficiently, just like every other card slot. If you're going to devote card slots to hosing specific colors, that's not always going to work out real well for you. I mean, if the metagame is shifted to everybody's running one color, then everybody's going to obviously run that color of color hoser, and the game adapts and shifts, and that's just how Magic is played. So, sure, you can do this, but at your peril, because what are you not playing because you're just kind of scared of a certain color? Use them kind of lightly, I would say. Use them as a sideboard tech, not as maybe a main focus. But no, I don't think it's a problem for Magic necessarily. It can be frustrating to play against. At the same time, there's ways around those. Everything's got a balance, and if you plan well, you're not going to get hit too hard by it.
I think they're totally fine. I mean, the ones they put in this set aren't super powerful. You know, they essentially, Jace's Defeat is essentially gainsay with, you know, a Scry 2 attached if it's a Jace Planeswalker. I think they're totally fine. They help to shore up your matchups. Now, the Liliana's Defeat, I will say that one looks really, really, really powerful. I mean, I'm glad they didn't make that an instant, but holy crap, is that card powerful. I expect to see that in some, definitely in sideboards in Modern, possibly even Legacy. Overall, though, I don't think it's a bad thing. I think it's a good thing, and I don't think it's feel bads for anybody, especially, you know, if they're being run in the sideboard. Now, Sean, since you talked about that, I want to talk about one other card that's kind of a build-around-me card, and that's Abandoned Sarcophagus. 3 mana for an artifact that says you may cast non-land cards with cycling from your graveyard. If a card with cycling would be put into your graveyard from anywhere and it wasn't cycled, exile it. What do you think of that one?
I think this might be the build around me card of the set. The fact that it's colorless is going to let you experiment with different colors to pair along with it. Cycling on a lot of cards is also colorless, so you're not restricted by that avenue. I think, does this take the spot of the New Perspectives deck? Because that asks you to play the game in a very specific way, whereas this is going to allow you to sort of develop your own ways to maybe win the game or how you want to get there with Abandoned Sarcophagus. Remember, it says cards with cycling that go to your graveyard that weren't cycled, you can play them. So you can cycle them for the card draw and value that they give you and then play them from your graveyard. So to me, this is just an extension of the value that you see in some formats that use the graveyard as a resource. Did Wizards print enough graveyard hate along the way? We'll see, depending on how this deck or theory rises or falls. It may not be good enough. It may be something that you just see at kitchen tables or at your more casual FNMs along the way. But I think it gives you a build around me card that I like the fact, Brian, that it's colorless because it lets you experiment with all the other colors that could interact with it.
Absolutely. It's definitely a build around, and it's something that you kind of have to focus on, a cycling theme. It's definitely going to be powerful to the people who are smart enough to take advantage of it. It seems to me like these are going to be the popular decks. You're going to have to decide what kind of cyclers you want, what kind of cycling cost you want. Is a Sweltering Suns to cycle for three, is that going to be value efficient as opposed to something like a Sensor for one blue that cycles, or the cycle lands for two colorless? You know, I think that's going to be the big question. What's the value of that to you to have it in your graveyard and then to get this out? And then is there enough artifact hate to get rid of this to maybe kind of hose your entire plan? Just like Sean said, color hosers are a thing. Are artifacts, you know, like Cast Out and things like that, are those going to be the kinds of cards that could just take this whole synergy away from you in one fell swoop? And you're like, well, what am I going to do now? So, you know, kind of going very linear like that, even though it's a little off the wall, is very intriguing to me. Whether it kind of stands up over the test of time and over the test of the meta is going to be an interesting question.
Yeah, and this is one of those cards that we talked about in a set that might not be obvious with its power, but its subtle power is there. The obvious build around me card is Bolas Godferal, the Planeswalker. But this Abandoned Sarcophagus is a little less obvious, but just because it's less obvious doesn't mean it's less powerful. Bolas takes a lot of work to set up in order to reap that reward. Abandoned Sarcophagus is going to take work to set up to reap that reward. And I think they'll just be powerful in sort of different angles of the metagame.
I'm very interested just overall to see what happens with that card, because that one definitely caught my eye. And it was one of those they threw out kind of with a bulk amount of other cards. So a lot of people didn't see it, because when they revealed it, there was like 30 other cards that came out that day. Usually they put the more powerful cards up front and then they kind of like let the, you know, the jank rares kind of go towards the back. And that may end up as a jank rare, but at the same time, I'm like, that could be a really powerful enabler. I think that you're right, Sean, being an artifact, you know, I think that's a huge, huge bonus. There's really not those cards. There's not Surgical Extraction out there that'll remove all those cards from your deck, so it doesn't immediately nullify your entire, if you build around that card, like your entire deck.
Should be interesting to see what gets developed as Hour of Devastation rolls out at the pre-release this weekend. Getting the cards you want at a pre-release is a skill. Now, I'm not talking about opening them. I'm talking about knowing the value of what you have, what to trade for, what to trade for in the past to get new cards going forward, and what to get rid of at pre-release to get value from the past. Yeah, there's a lot of ins and outs when it comes to finances, and one of those cards from the past that you could be getting great value for now is our In the Elevator pick this week. Matt, go ahead and take us for a ride.
Kolrath Knight from Shadowmoor. With Wither and creatures your opponents control with counters on them can't attack or block. Dig through your bulk, because these cards are about $4 now. This goes in all these Scorpion God EDH decks. This is a card that, since it's hybrid black and red and hybrid black and red, is not going to be easy to reprint. Start selling these out. If you have extras, take them to your pre-release. It's going to spike here, and then it's going to go back down. So Kolrath Knight, go ahead and sell them.
Kolrath Knight in the elevator this week here on Try Hards. Let's get our brew hat on. This is one that I've been excited about since it was released. Got a little bit of Johnny in me. I like to go for the big play now and again. We're about to find out whether or not that may actually come to pass. Our brewmaster has us frothed up. What do you got, Brian?
I get nervous every time you say brewmaster, but I'll take it. I'll take it. Absolutely.
It's a double entendre that fits you.
This is true. No, this is true. I'm very excited about this card, and what fitting card on the week before pre-release that we actually get a card that has the namesake of the set. Hour of Devastation, the sorcery, 2 red and 3 other. All creatures lose indestructible until end of turn. Hour of Devastation deals 5 damage to each creature and each non-Bolas Planeswalker. Is this going to be the card around which Bolas needs 3 or 4 of guys, or is this going to find its way into other decks that currently exist or we have not yet seen? Sean, I'm going to start with you about Hour of Devastation. Where do you best see this card?
I think this is a perfect sweeper under the New World Order of what Wizards wants, and that's 5-drop sweepers that have upside attached to them. We've seen a 3-drop with downside in Bantu's Last Reckoning. I don't think control decks are going to want to go through an entire turn cycle without untapping their lands, though. But this gives you everything you need. It takes Indestructible away. So now you've hosed all of the blue-white flyers decks that are relying on sacrificing a spirit to make their stuff indestructible. You're able to sweep planeswalkers off the board. A Gideon is only indestructible on the turn that he attacks. So I think this gives you a lot of reach. I don't think it's a 3 or 4 card option. I think it's a 1, probably another 1 out of the sideboard, depending on your matchup. But just to absolutely say, we're going to clear the board and almost restart the game from right now. The only piece of text that this is missing to have me just completely salivating over myself would be, this spell can't be countered. I mean, if it had that, it would probably be too good at 5 mana.
Hurley, what about you? Where do you see Hour of Devastation fitting in the new standard meta?
I really like this card, but I'm a little worried since it is a 5-drop. It's in that weird place where you have to cast it on 5 or 6, and it's easily censored. That's my big worry about it. I really like Hour of Revelation better, even though that's triple whites. But I do think that Hour of Devastation is really, really powerful. It just kind of depends where the format goes. Maybe you can get by with casting this on turn 7, holding up counter, you know, like a negate backup or whatever counter you have, sensor. This card just seems awesome, and it's got a ton of flavor to it. I definitely think it's going to be a player, but it's going to be a card that goes up and down in value very, very, very quickly. You know, as people start to put 2 in their main deck, it will go down in value as people adjust to it. And then all of a sudden it's going to pop back up a month later. And so it's going to go, it's going to be a roller coaster. But yeah, I love this card.
I'm really excited. Sean, you said something that was very, very intriguing to me about how powerful it would be if it said this card can't be countered. And I kind of got erect in my chair thinking, wait a minute, what are you talking about? That would be nuts. But at the same time, all the flavor text on this card kind of leads it to think that it couldn't be countered. The Nicol Bolas is the proposed flavor text writer of this. Everything here exists or perishes at my whim, including you, Gatewatch. Very, very foreboding, you know, lines there, foreboding words. So I think that actually might not be a bad line of text, and it could be one of those kind of breakout rares from the set. I still think this is going to be a great, great sweeper in all kinds of continuing red shells, including blue-red shells, including any kind of teamer things that aren't using small creatures. This is definitely something that the blue-white monuments deck is going to definitely have to worry about. Something like a Mardu Vehicles, which I know has kind of fallen off right now, is going to have to worry about as well. But the 5-drop, Hurley, I think you're right. It is tricky. You have to kind of weigh this against some of the other things. And yeah, if you try to cast this and it gets censored, if you haven't cycled your censor by then, I'm kind of thinking, what are you doing not cycling your censor by turn 5? However, I think you're right. That could be an absolute blowout if you're looking to sweep the board and start over from scratch. And that doesn't happen. You might just be up the unsanitary tributary without a means of locomotion, as my grandpa used to say. It's going to be a really, really great card to see what the pros do with. I'm looking to put one of these in red, blue-red spells. I don't know if it's going to go main or if it's going to go sideboard yet, if it's going to take up a Sweltering Sun spot. That card just has so much value because of the cycling ability. Is this good enough to do that? I'm very, very excited about this card and seeing how it hits on the opening weekend of tournament play.
Hour of Devastation, our 3 minutes to brew card this week on Tryhard. That brings us up to what we did to get better at Magic this week. Matt, you were the pilot for our Patreon invite outing over the weekend. What'd you learn to get better at Magic?
I learned that I can't read so good. And so I put 18 lands in our deck instead of 16 lands and cut two important cards from it because, you know, I'm a brain dead idiot sometimes. You know, this is the first time I've played Legacy in a while. It just was refreshing my my memory from all of the Storm matchups, the mono-black hex depths. You know, I kind of totally forgot that the format was as open as it actually is. I always try to get down on Wednesdays, and usually something comes up. But I think this Wednesday I'm going to try my to get down there and play some down to the shop and play some Legacy. I know that everyone wants to kind of start spooling up before the Eternal Weekend in October.
So. Brian, Matt's absolutely right about Eternal Weekend coming up in Pittsburgh. We'll have the tryhards there. You played a lot of Magic this weekend. What'd you do to get better?
Kind of learned that, hey, when the deck plays a certain way, I should play it that way. My blue-red deck, I kind of jumped the gun a little bit on casting Gear Hulks in a couple of rounds, and I think it cost me some games, probably some matches. But other than that, playing multiple formats this weekend just reminded me how fun this game is across multiple levels. I feel like it's one of those things that if I try to explain this game to board game players, it's kind of like saying, well, imagine they came out with a different module or a different expansion to this game. That's kind of like what this game is all the time to me. I can just go and play very different expansions whenever I want to, and I can just kind of have them ready to go. My family loves to play Ticket to Ride, and Ticket to Ride has been around for a while and has multiple expansions. We still like the original, but it's still like, huh, what would be the modern equivalent of Ticket to Ride? What would be the legacy equivalent of Ticket to Ride? I think that's what we're playing is the original. So anyway, the other thing about this is I was really, really tickled to be able to play Legacy with all of us on the same cast and kind of in Hurley's ear telling him what to do and what not to do, and just how complicated Legacy can be. And we can take multiple lines and they can be right or wrong. I think that's the thing about that blue red deck is it gives us a lot of different options. And at the same time, some of them were right. Some of them are maybe not as right as they could be, but you just don't know because it's going to depend on what you draw, what your opponent does, etc. Sean called one of the plays that we made, and I just had to kind of lean back and laugh and be like, yep, well, that didn't work out for us, so that's part of the game. And so that was a lot of fun. I'm really, really looking forward to kind of nailing down a Legacy deck for Eternal Weekend in Pittsburgh and kind of playtesting that from now through the middle of October and seeing what I can come up with. Just getting a lot of Magic under my belt, I think, reminded me just how fun and thoughtful this game really is again.
Yeah, I would concur with Brian's play as a team outlet. This was what I did to get better this weekend, was playing with a new partner, playing with the Padawan Rachel at the team draft. This made me think about the game a little bit of a different way. It made me think about player strengths and weaknesses. And I think being around the game as long as we have, guys, we stop thinking about it. Not because we're omniscient when it comes to play patterns, because we're certainly not, but we just know our own game very well. We know what we're good at, and we naturally gravitate toward decks and strategies that give us that edge and stay away from ones that we're not as good at. And thinking about, okay, what is she? Somebody who's been learning the game for 90 days. What are her strengths? Putting together a deck, putting together two decks that work together. This was the moment that I was most proud of myself for over the weekend. It wasn't during any sort of run of play or a sanctioned match. We agreed on both decks, and then I asked her. I had an answer that I was hoping to hear, and I did eventually get it, but I asked her, because I'm still interested in developing her as a player, which deck do you want to pilot? And I was really hoping she'd say the mono white deck and leave me the kind of complicated Grixis control cycling deck. And she hemmed and hawed and thought about it. And she said, maybe I should play the mono white deck. And I was relieved, but I said to her, okay, if that's the one you want, then we'll go for it that way. But just putting those things together while you're thinking about strengths and weaknesses reminded me that I need to think about what mine are and work on those along the way as well. That's what I did to get better at Magic this weekend. Oh, you brave soul, hanging out for a 4th of July episode of Tryhards. We'll catch you again next week. Have fun at your pre-release.